Welcome to Critical Issues Commentary, the radio ministry of Twin City Fellowship. I'm Pastor Bob DeWay, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. And today, I'm interviewing Ryan Flynn, author of Running Against the Wind. And we're talking about the contents of his book, and we're doing a series of radio shows based on his excellent book about how God saved him out of the New Age and has raised him up to warn the church about New Age practices coming into the church. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
You're welcome. We are now beginning chapter 3 of your book, in which you share your story about some of the various practices that you got into as you were searching for spiritual reality. And last week we talked about your early life in the Air Force, and now you're in Minneapolis, right?
Correct.
At this point. And according to what you said in chapter 3 here, you begin to learn transcendental meditation.
Right. It was a girl I was dating at the time, and she was into it, and her sister and her husband were both teachers of transcendental meditation. And she just said, you know, it was really a wonderful thing for stress, and she shared how much it gave her a feeling of peace. And so I was looking for the same thing. You know, I was looking for peace in my life. You know, I was in stressful situations in my life. I was still, you know, in a band and working part-time, trying to make ends meet. And so I thought it would be a great thing to learn. So she invited me to go to a class, and I went to the class. And I remember at the time that it was $400 for it, but I told them that I was in school, so they gave me a discount that was $200.
So you got your spiritual bodies cheaper.
Yes, I got a good discount. And it was a four-week course. We met once a week, and the teacher gave me the concepts of transcendental meditation. And she said that by giving me this word, which they called a mantra, which means liberation of thought, or be liberated from thought, and that I would repeat this word over and over and over again. Now, what was interesting at that time was she said, well, as we go, as I get to know you, I will select a word for you that will be yours only. And they emphasized the point not to share it with anybody else, that this was my word and it supposedly had power, and I wasn't to share it with anybody else because somehow it would diminish its meaning.
Okay, so you get a secret word. It's just for you.
Just for me.
Okay. And the point was, so mantra means freedom from thought.
Yes.
Or being released from thought. So the goal of your practice of transcendental meditation was to achieve thoughtlessness?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, I thought that was billed as a good thing.
Okay.
So what she would do is that she would introduce the word to me, and she would have me say it out loud with her. And then I would continue to repeat it out loud, and then she instructed me to slowly but surely say it more quietly, until I was only stating it internally.
Okay.
And as I did that, she said, now here's what's going to happen. She goes, I want you to concentrate on that word. But she goes, as human beings, we're going to occasionally have a thought. And she goes, don't try to suppress the thought. Just have it for a moment. You know, your mind is going to be distracted. You're going to have those inevitable distractions. And, you know, have the thought, but then bring it back to the mantra. And so it was kind of a back and forth in my mind for a moment where I'd say the mantra over and over again, and then I'd have a thought, then I'd return to the mantra, then I'd have another thought. And then slowly but surely, the thoughts disappeared, and so did the mantra.
Wow.
So I reached the silence, which was the goal.
That happened the very first time?
Very first time.
Wow.
Yep.
So
it wasn't hard to learn. I probably was into the silence within maybe 5 minutes.
Wow.
And you do it for about a 20-minute time period.
Now, did they tell you that there was any religious connotation to this practice?
Well, one of the leading mantras of transcendental meditation is, this is not a religion. That's the one that they emphasized all the time.
Because they're trying to sell it to Americans as a stress relief?
Correct. That was really the way it was sold. The Maharishi, when they came to the United States, had decided that the best way to market it was a stress reliever. And so they tried to use Western science to back up their claims that they could prove that a person's heart rate would go down or blood pressure would go down.
Okay.
And there were studies that did conclude that. So they weren't off base. But I suppose if you were just sitting quietly doing anything, your heart rate may go down. But whether it really was backed up by science or not, I don't think most people particularly cared. I think that they were looking for stress relief, and this was an interesting method to achieve it.
So when you went and started practicing this, you didn't connect it with any religious ideas?
Not really, not to me. I just looked at it as a practice, and I probably wouldn't have cared if it was a religious practice or not at that time. I was just looking for some type of an experience, and I got it. And there was that time period when I was doing the meditation where I remember having a thought. I did realize time passed when I got to my next thought. I remember that clearly, that, oh, there was a whole time period there where I had no thought. And as you did it more and more, the more quickly you'd be able to reach that silence and stay there for a length of time.
Now, do they call that nirvana?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, it was really the achievement. I mean, I think it's more of a lifelong achievement to reach this state of peace. So by doing it for 20 minutes twice each day, once in the morning, once in the evening, they believe that you would have more peace in your life. And in my estimation, after the first session ended, I remember saying to the teacher after it ended, I just went, wow, that was great.
Wow.
And she started laughing. She goes, oh, this is so fun for me because everybody has the same reaction you just did. It works right away.
But so, later, I know I saw in your seminar, you found out that these mantras were, there's only so many of them based on your age?
Correct. There's only 16 of them.
And where do they come from originally?
Well, they're words from Sanskrit. I was always told this, that they really had no meaning whatsoever. They were just sounds. They were word parts that they had no meaning. But in my later research, what I found that they're the names of Hindu gods.
That's what I thought.
So there is a meaning there. And as you graduate, they add on to that your original word. So you're actually saying an entire phrase.
I see.
And the phrase is usually that I bow down or I worship that particular god.
So they're leading you into Eastern religion under the guise of lower your blood pressure.
Correct.
Okay. I think later we'll come back to this when we talk about the Christian versions of it that are essentially the same thing, only with different words.
Correct.
Okay. So then I was reading in your book that you lost interest in this. So it seems kind of odd to me that if it was such a great experience, what made you lose interest in it?
I think there was a couple of reasons. One is the relationship between myself and that woman ended, so maybe that took away some of my motivation. The other is that I don't think I had the discipline in that to get up every single solitary day and do it 20 minutes every day, 20 minutes in the evening, I think I just lost my motivation. Or maybe I didn't really see all that much life-changing result that I had hoped for.
Okay.
And I think that's quite common in the New Age, is that's why they go from one discipline to the next, or one next guru or book or practice, is because eventually they don't see that much change.
Yeah, right. These things really don't have the power to change anybody's life.
Nope.
The only thing they do is get you into religious bondage.
Yep.
And so they got to keep having a different version of it.
Yeah, they keep on repeating over and over again similar themes, but a new practice. And then when I hear about a New Ager that's, oh, into this new practice, what they just proved is, I guess, the old thing they were into didn't actually work. You're really not getting ultimate satisfaction. It's that you're constantly searching. You find something that supposedly works, but not enough. It's just not the final answer to really understanding or having a relationship with God or whatever I dreamed it at the time, the universe or whatever. It just was never the final answer.
Yeah, that very much reminds me of Christians that are looking for some kind of experience because evidently they don't have good teaching. They don't understand the sufficiency of Christ. You know, there's meetings where people go get slain under the power, as they call it.
Yep.
And that's the great new thing. Then they have some prophet that's going to come tell them prophetic things and that never work out. And then they have a laughing revival and they go to the meetings and laugh, and that's going to make them closer to God. And it's sad, but in a sense, they're repeating what the New Age is doing. They're looking for an experience that's going to give them something that evidently they don't see that they have in Christ, or maybe they just have bad doctrine.
Yeah, it's true. They just are not satisfied with what the gospel has given them.
Exactly.
That is the common theme.
Right. And so chasing after experiences, those people that do that are always going to need a different one because the last one will get boring or not sufficient. Okay, so in your book, you mentioned that you went back to doing your music and met a girl who also didn't like Christians very much. Is that right?
Yep. I met a woman that I eventually married, and that was one of the things that we had in common. She was more of a real free spirit person and was into a lot of different New Age philosophies and techniques and things like that. And so we kind of hit it off. We both had disdain for Christians. We both thought that they were judgmental and mean-spirited and pretty much all the things that, you know, a lot of people think about Christians. And so we had a very close relationship, and we just hit it off for that reason. We had the same spiritual beliefs.
Okay. Were you starting to hear the term New Age at that time yourself?
Yeah. I never consider myself a New Ager. I don't think any New Ager runs around and says that they're New Agers. You know, it's not something that people talk about. The phrase now is that I'm very spiritual.
Okay.
Whenever you hear that, that usually means non-Christian.
That they're in the New Age or something like it. Sort of like Oprah Winfrey type being spiritual.
Yeah. It's, well, I'm very spiritual. I believe in God, but I don't believe that anyone has a particular right answer. And, oh, I pray and I meditate and I read all the positive books about the universe and things like that. But usually they're into some type of practice of some sort, or their philosophy of life is that God is a source of love, and the closer you get to that source, the more loving and kind a person you'll be, or the more you will grow.
Okay. I noticed you mentioned something about escaping boundaries and the Western mindset. Now, the reason that struck me as I was reading your book was it reminds me of the debate I had with an emergent church leader, and I was pointing out that God does draw boundaries. And he just couldn't stand the idea that there's any boundaries. And I see a lot of similarity between what's going on in the emergent church and this other version of spirituality. And they both see what the Western, quote, Christian mindset is the big enemy.
Correct, because the Western mindset is rational and logical. And we must free ourselves from that. Because what I was always told, and part of my problem was a lot of my New Age teachers would tell me, is that I kept on thinking too much. I kept on rationalizing. I kept on trying to figure it out. And they kept on saying, you just need to be free of this. Just let go. Stop trying to analyze it to death and just let go. Let the spirit flow. Let these emotions happen. Let the experience, just accept the experience as it is without trying to figure it all out. So I can see why the emergent church is the same way, because their whole thing is based on experience.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting during that debate, all that I could think of the entire time was that the emergent church leader was espousing the same beliefs that I did when I was in the New Age. I didn't believe in the authority of Scripture. I thought boundaries were self-imposed, not by someone else's doctrine. So I could understand his resentment. It was the same resentment I had when I was in the New Age.
Wow.
But he doesn't believe he's in the New Age.
Huh.
He calls himself a Christian, but their beliefs are the same. I've said this before when I watched the debate. If I'd come in there not knowing either one when I was a New Ager, I would have said, well, you got this Christian on one side, and you've got this open-minded New Ager on the other side who kind of says he's a Christian. But I would have taken his side of the debate the entire way.
When you were in a New Age.
But I shouldn't have.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this debate, by the way, was with Doug Padgett, and it was taped, so you can still get that. If you want,
if anybody wants to see it, it's worthwhile.
It's really very interesting. It's basically two people in two different worlds. In fact, his version of it, I was looking at some links on Google about it, and they call their version, I gave him a copy of it, so they have it out there, too. They love their position. They got the chance to...
Oh, they think they're right. And they think you're right.
They called me... Well, basically, they call it a trip to the other side. So I'm over on this other side, like one of those stodgy Christians that believe there's boundaries.
Right. Well, you are on the other side of them.
I know. So it's very telling because it's really not the same religion.
Correct.
Well, so you were escaping boundaries, escaping the Western mindset, exploring what we call the New Age, and you considered, you know, the spiritual forces of the universe to mm-hmm. tap into. And you ran across, then, according to your book, Anthony Robbins.
Yep.
Tell me about Robbins and any of this NLP.
Neuro-linguistic programming.
All right, let's find out about that one.
Well, Tony Robbins at the time in the early 90s was kind of the self-help guru. And I was trying to do anything I could to be successful. I wanted more wealth. And I felt that my past and my history and my thought processes were holding me back, that I just needed to get past these ideas of lack. You know, the New Age, while it talks about love and charity, there's another part of it which really desires great wealth and success. They want both. So the other side of it is this self-improvement process, but they do so from a spiritual way. Now, Tony Robbins isn't really spiritual, but he uses kind of dynamics that can change your mindset. So the ones that he talks about, now, he didn't invent NLP, but it's a way of thinking in which you can change your future through your mind. Now, one of the things that he would talk about is anchoring. Now, there's probably been times in your life where you really need to feel positive at a certain moment. Well, how do you do that? Well, he would explain that, well, his analogy was, let's say a person went through a very painful situation in their lives, maybe a death of their parent, and everyone came up and kept on squeezing them on the shoulder. And that was a physical reinforcement of this memory. So then someone, you know, months from now squeezes them on the shoulder and it triggers a memory.
Okay. Sounds like some of these inner healing theories.
Correct. Well, his theory was, well, let's try to use that for the positive. Let's anchor a memory and then physically touch a part of your body that will remind you back to that state. So he'll say, okay, think of a time when you felt really positive about yourself. Now I want you to, for example, squeeze the end of your pinky.
Okay.
And while you're thinking of that memory, really, really squeeze it so that you're anchoring that memory through touch. So the next time you need some type of upliftment, well, you just squeeze that pinky. It triggers the memory and you're in a positive state of mind.
What do you know? So all that easy.
So I was trying all these different methods, and I'm not saying that they won't necessarily work, but they're really temporary little things, because you're not getting to the root cause of man's dilemma, and that is truly sin.
Yeah, which they don't ever talk about.
Of course not. So all of these things are what I kind of view as riding a tricycle when God has given you a jet airliner. They're just the best man can come up with.
Oh.
And of course, that's always less than what God can provide.
Right, and what God is going to provide is forgiveness of sins through Jesus Christ, who died for sins, who rose again on the third day, and eternal life.
Right.
And this life is very temporary, and however positive our mental attitude might be, we're going to die.
Yep.
And there is an eternity, and there is a judgment. But that's what they deny, that there's a future judgment.
And then you go to his other seminars, and they get into deeper stuff, and then you go to his other seminars. In the meantime, you probably spent about $50,000 to find out that you know, you had problems with your mom when you were a kid or something like that.
Wow.
So it's really just pop psychology with neuro-linguistic programming.
Okay.
It's a form of mind programming.
Mind over matter type thing.
Correct.
Okay. None of this is new. This stuff was around 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah. It's really nothing new. It's just got a new spin on it.
Yeah, for example, this Emile Coué from France, I think this was the early part of the 20th century, was going around filling auditoriums telling people the secret was to repeat this phrase that he'd come up with. And it was, every day and every way I'm getting better and better. And some people would say that over, and it was called Coué-ism. That was
That. Yeah. I didn't know it came from anywhere. I was wondering where that came from.
Yeah, it was somebody's self-help thing from like 1910 or somewhere.
Well, the interesting thing, though, where is Tony Robbins today?
Yeah, what happened to all his infomercials?
Well,
he's probably bought an island somewhere.
Yeah, he's tremendously wealthy. He's still around. But I think what's interesting, why aren't his tapes and books really selling big any longer? Because I think a lot of people have moved on to the next new thing. If that was the final answer, everyone would still be buying the book.
Yeah.
But, of course, they're not.
So they move on to something else, just like you did.
Yep.
Moved on to the next
thing. Always moving on to the next new thing.
Well, according to your book, the next new thing was the Celestine Prophecy.
Yep, the Celestine Prophecy, written by Redman. That was a really popular book in the mid to late 90s. And this was a book that was actually a work of fiction. And that was what was so funny about it. When I heard an interview with the author, they'd ask him, well, this book is fiction, right? Well, yes, it is. But he didn't want to deny it too much because so many people were turning it into a religion. He didn't want to deny it was something he completely made up. So it's a fictional story that there are these nine insights that were found in South America. They unearthed this information. And there's all these nine insights that the number one is that nothing is a chance coincidence. The reason that you and I are speaking on the radio right now is not a chance coincidence.
It's not an accident. Remember we talked about that when we did a series on my book about Rick Warren. He said the same thing. It's not an accident that you're reading his book.
What was your response?
it's not an accident that I'm doing a radio show rebuking him for writing the book.
Correct.
I mean, that argument, what does it prove?
Well, I know. I make a joke in my seminar. I had this woman that just said she lost a red pen in an airport, and then she got to the next airport and was going to the phone, and she picked up, guess what? There it was, the same type of pen, a red pen, just like the one she had lost. And of course, the deep meaning of that is,
I don't know.
I have no idea. So, and the book goes on to energy manipulation and being able to see people's auras and be able to connect with people. But at the end of the book was some way of bringing you to a higher spiritual level where you'd become, in a sense, a super being. So this goes beyond the self-help to the spiritual self-help, to where you become to the point of having powers like God.
Wow, there's just the lie in the Garden of Eden all over again.
Absolutely. That's where all of these lead to, is self-improvement, like Tony Robbins, has been replaced by self-improvement of a spiritual nature, because they figured out, and they're correct, that there is a spiritual problem. But they are trying to correct it through means that will never get them there.
Well, they can say there's no such thing as sin, but they can't change the fact they really are sinners.
That's correct.
And they're mortal, and they're facing judgment. That all those things can't be changed just by changing your mental attitude.
Well, they believe that there is no final judgment. There is no God that is judgmental. It's just that God is disappointed that we haven't figured out yet that we can be just like him.
Yeah, we can solve the world's problems on our own.
And that's the problem. We just aren't spiritual enough, Bob. We just haven't released all of the energy of the universe that is within us. That's the reason we have such confrontation. If all of us were meditating, if all of us really knew that we are God-like, then we could have world peace.
Oh, wow.
That's the philosophy.
Yeah, it's just a delusion, but I think it's a setup for the Antichrist.
It is, because as soon as that person comes along, we will follow, because the philosophy has already been laid down.
Yeah, and they're looking for that, and plus they're connected to the source,
yep,
spiritual source, which we know to be Satan.
Correct.
But they believe that it's God or the universe or
sure,
whatever. The same person that was in this Unity church that I witnessed to one time said to me, I'm putting myself in the hands of the universe. And I said, the universe is impersonal. The universe is created. So what makes you think the universe cares about you?
And, by the way, the universe is going to end.
Yeah, it's finite, which scientists believe is going to die of heat death.
So you're relying on something that won't be around forever.
You're relying on the finite, and you're relying on the impersonal.
Correct.
God is infinite and personal. There's something that you mentioned in this experience, the energy. You were talking about the higher energy states that we were just talking about, and the energy of the universe. And you mentioned an experience of the interconnectedness of all things.
Right.
That, I think we should discuss that topic because I run across that also in the emergent church.
That's true. It's called monism. It's really, you know, the New Age borrows a lot from Eastern religions. A great deal of it is Eastern religions. And one of them is that we are all interconnected. We are all as one. It's just, again, the same point. We just don't realize it. So we have a connectedness between all living beings and the earth itself, so that all is one, one is all, and that's all there is. So the premise of that, of course, is that we are not separate beings. We are not unique. We are equivalent to the animals. You know, a great deal of the philosophy behind those that that believe in Darwin's theory is we're just another animal, no better or worse than any other.
Well, isn't there a little bit of irony there? Because on the one hand, they're claiming they're ascending to godhood. On the other hand, they're claiming they're no different or better than the animals. So in one way, it exalts man in an idolatrous way. And on the other hand, it debases man by saying we're no better than animals.
You just hit on the ultimate contradiction, which is the prevalent belief system of the New Age is always contradiction. They can't seem to understand that while they believe that God is somehow an impersonal like the universe, they also will pray to a being that will talk to them. Now, how can an impersonal being talk, think, or love?
Wow.
They don't see that even within a particular day that they are believing that God is both impersonal and personal at the same time. That's impossible. That's like believing that 2 plus 2 equals 4 and 5.
Wow. You know, we have this DVD of your seminar, and I was watching one through the other day to make sure the quality is okay because we're using it for mastering. And you had this little thing. You were quoting all these contradictions that they were asserting at the same time. I don't remember which slide it was in your presentation, but it was a whole series of contradictions from a New Agers saying you're supposed to believe all these things simultaneously, which is impossible.
Right, because you're supposed to be open-minded. If you ever question an idea of the New Age, it's evidence that you're still closed-minded.
So all you end up with is blind credulity.
Correct.
And you really can't believe a contradiction, which is what I was debating that emergent church guy about. So that a contradiction is a meaningless thing. You can't believe a contradiction because it's not even describable. In other words, like a square circle.
Correct.
You can't believe in a square circle because a contradiction is meaningless and can't be.
I even used the example of 2 plus 2 equal 5. I actually had a New Age friend that just said, well, I have heard that some scientists say that's a possibility. You know, but the reason why she reacted that way to something so definitive is that concept is beyond her comprehension because she's been so put in this position of, I can't be resistant to anyone else's ideas because the greatest sin of the New Age is narrow-mindedness.
Wow. So you are studying this interconnectedness in this Celestine prophecies and emerging higher energy states. Did you fully adopt this Redfield's idea of untapped energy?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the key, I thought, to power, wealth, and happiness, was if I could key into this energy that's the energy of the universe. And it's stated throughout the New Age is that if you can tap into this energy source, then your life can dramatically change for the better.
Did they ever think about just getting an education and getting a job and working harder?
They believed in the future. I think Redfield's next book, I didn't read it, but he believed that if all of us are doing this, that money won't really be necessary because we will all voluntarily give our talents to each other. We're all unique in which each of us have a particular talent, and where I might be able to conjure up something, you'll be able to do something else and trade, and then we'll have this wonderful world peace not based on a monetary system.
So, again, another contradiction. So you get caught into this thinking that you're going to learn how to make money, you know, yep, by positive thinking or relaxation or tapping into energy or higher human potential. And then when you get fully into it, you find out you don't need any of these things anyhow.
Yeah, and of course, all of these guys don't seem to mind when their book sells millions. It's just all these guys that show proof that, see, I can do it also, read my book, buy my book. Well, no one can duplicate selling your book.
Right.
So you see these people as an example of success, but their success is based upon you buying their book.
Yeah, isn't that the way
So you can't duplicate these particular things.
So you took all that energy you put into it and focused on one career or job or something that somebody's willing to pay you for your talents and worked harder, you'd be a lot further ahead.
And then the problem is, guess what? It's just like the philosophy within the church, the prosperity consciousness. Well, what happens when you fail? Whose fault is that?
It's not the fault of the guy that taught you how to be prosperous.
No, you just didn't learn his lessons well enough. Wow. You didn't meditate enough. It's all your fault. So when you fail, it's your responsibility. And so, that's why these people are depressed so often, is because they're doing these disciplines and they're going nowhere.
We're out of time for this week, but next week we'll go further and talking with Brian. And your story was, it didn't make you successful.
It didn't at all. It destroyed me.
Yes. And so it's a very deceptive world out there. And God was gracious and intervened in Brian's life and saved him and taught him the truth. And we're here to warn people also that the only way to find the truth is through Jesus Christ.
Amen.
And submitting to him and his word. Because his word is God's word, and it cannot fail. This is a Critical Issues Commentary, the radio ministry of Twin City Fellowship. You can contact us, by the way. We have two websites, cicministry.org, where you'll find articles on many theological issues and apologetic issues, or twincityfellowship.com, where you can listen to sermons and hear Bible teachings. And Brian, what's your website?
It's onetruthministries.com. That's O-N-E, truthministries.com.
Okay, and you can get a copy of Brian's book by going to his website. This is Pastor Bob DeWay from Twin City Fellowship. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.